This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
India and Bangladesh rely on the monsoon season for their water, but current downpours are devastating areas and displacing millions.
So the amount of rainfall that a region would get over a couple of months is all being dumped in the span of a few weeks.
A problem that's projected to get worse with climate change. Also ahead, the U.S. cracks down on imports made with forced labor in China. One problem, the items will be hard to track.
There's a high risk that most of us have goods that are made with Uyghur forced labor in our purses, on our desks, in our closets.
I'm Carol Hills, and talk about an inconvenience. Across the Middle East, cheating on exams is rampant. One solution, cut the internet. Across an entire nation.
Human rights activists are very angry. It's an infringement on people's freedom, and it's just really tricky to get by day to day without internet.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. That's a sound that tens of millions of Indians and Bangladeshis have been hearing for nearly a week now. Heavy rains that have led to major flooding across parts of Bangladesh and India. Millions of people have been displaced and dozens are dead. Officials are describing it as the worst flooding in 100 years. Joining us now from Hyderabad, India, is freelance reporter Sushmita Pathak. Sushmita, update us on the situation right now. Is it still raining?
It is still raining in parts of eastern India and Bangladesh. And I was speaking to a UNICEF official just now, and he described the flood as a flood of biblical proportions. You know, around 70 people have died in the past 2 weeks due to floods and landslides. Some people in Bangladesh were killed by lightning strikes, and about 10 million people are now displaced. That's more than the entire population of Massachusetts. Some of those who've lost their homes are now in relief camps, and authorities in both countries are trying to reach those who are stranded.
So what are officials saying about how they're going to deal with this situation? What's the challenge here?
I spoke to UNICEF's Bangladesh representative, Sheldon Yet, and he says the biggest challenge is access.
Airports are closed, roads are closed, so trucks have to take a roundabout ways and brave floodwaters to get supplies where they need to go. We just dispatched 12 trucks full of water purification tablets and basic supplies for women and children.
This part of the world gets hit with floods pretty consistently. I mean, doesn't this happen every year?
You're right. June to September is monsoon season, and you know it's crucial for agriculture. But it also causes huge loss to life and damages crops every year. And scientists are saying climate change is making extreme weather more common. So the amount of rainfall that a region would get over a couple of months is all being dumped in the span of a few weeks. And what's interesting is that Assam saw floods last month too, even before the monsoon technically arrived.
We've been talking mostly about Assam in India. You mentioned Bangladesh. What's happening there?
Yes, Bangladesh too is extremely vulnerable to these kinds of disasters. You know, it's a country with a lot of rivers, a lot of low-lying areas. Sheldon Yet actually described it as the poster child for climate change.
Floods and monsoon downpours are more frequent than they have been in the past. Bangladesh has been able to deal with these floods very well. But this one, it really is a massive flood. And with climate change, we're expecting more floods of this size, of this proportion. And that puts everybody at risk.
So, Sushmita, what's the forecast for the next few days? Any signs of a let up of the rain?
Officials in Assam yesterday said that water has started to recede in some parts, but in Bangladesh, more rain is likely over the next couple of days.
So, Sushmita, given the fact that this seems like it might be the norm, these irregular monsoons and accelerated raining, what is either India or Bangladesh doing about it to prepare for the next time this happens?
You know, I asked this to Sheldon Yet, and he said that actually Bangladesh has been doing quite a good job of managing floods. In recent years, they've improved quite a lot. But this year, the floods were so massive, the scale was so unprecedented, that there's just no way to prepare. And India, too, has been trying, you know. They've been looking into predictive technology to prepare for floods. A few years ago, scientists came up with a real-time flood forecasting system for urban areas. But again, climate change makes it difficult.
Sushmita Pathak is a freelance reporter based in Hyderabad in India. She's been reporting on the floods in parts of India and Bangladesh. Sushmita, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Blocked roads, burning tires, major unrest. That's the story in Ecuador this week as mass protests against the government of Guillermo Lasso have rippled across the country. They're being led by indigenous groups who accuse him of hurting their communities as he tries to shore up the economy. Michael Fox has the story.
On Monday, thousands of indigenous people from tribes across Ecuador marched to the capital, Quito. "The people united will never be defeated," chanted a mass of people as they crossed a bridge in the direction of the capital, live streamed over Facebook by one local news channel.
Con un solo pensamiento, con un solo corazón, seguiremos haciendo acción de lucha.
"We are here with one idea, one heart," said one of the leaders from the edge of the march, alongside a row of burning tires. "We will continue to fight until they respect our rights." Indigenous people make up roughly 6% of Ecuador's population, according to government figures, and many struggle with poverty and a lack of access to education. Indigenous communities in the Amazon have been devastated by foreign oil operations, and newer mining projects are also threatening their land. Conservative banker Guillermo Lasso was elected last year, promising to revive the economy, erase the deficit, and jumpstart oil deals. This didn't sit well with most indigenous groups. They've tried negotiating, but after getting nowhere, they started protesting last week. "Down with Lasso! Down with Lasso!" cried supporters lining the side of the road as indigenous people from the Amazon made their way through a town south of Quito. Indigenous leaders have 10 demands, including reducing the price of gas, halting new mining and gas projects, providing funds for healthcare and education, and economic relief for millions of families in debt.
Hemos solicitado de manera democrática en todo el año que sean escuchadas.
"For the last year, we have democratically requested that they listen to these 10 demands," said Leonidas Isa Salazar, the president of CONAIE, the country's largest indigenous confederation, which is leading the protests. "The president of the republic should respond to these substantial issues to support the Ecuadorian people," he said. State security forces have been cracking down on the protesters. Videos posted over social media show people running and state forces firing rubber bullets and tear gas canisters into crowds at close range. In another, a man's face is covered in blood. He takes a sip of water while someone yells, "Get him to the hospital!" President Lasso has instituted a curfew and is prohibiting large gatherings. Maria Espinosa is a lawyer with Amazon Frontlines, an NGO that supports indigenous groups in Ecuador.
Se está atacando de manera desproporcional.
She says government forces are using disproportionate force. They're using weapons not just with the goal of dispersing the crowds, but with the goal of attacking, she says. Dozens have been injured and detained. One person has been killed. As of Monday, roadblocks made of burning tires, trees, and debris stretched north and south across the country. "Here we are," yells someone off camera in this video shared over Twitter, as members of an Amazonian Shuar community stand around several huge trees blocking the highway. In a message over social media on Monday, President Lasso attacked the indigenous movements for violence and vandalism.
"No podemos permitir que unos pocos violentos..."
He said, "We cannot allow a few violent people from stopping millions of Ecuadorians from working," he said. "I am here to defend Quito, each family, and the country." But Lasso's words might be falling on deaf ears as more sectors of the middle class back the indigenous protests. During the pandemic, Ecuador's healthcare system and economy took a beating, and they still haven't rebounded. Quito-based political analyst Decio Machado says Lasso's popularity has now slumped below 20%. Lasso's government has its back against the wall, says Machado. The fear that it may fall is creating violent tension in the streets, and the situation of tension could result in many deaths. Last week, Lasso responded to the indigenous protests by promising to fix the healthcare system, double the budget for education in indigenous languages, and increase credit and subsidies for farm workers. Indigenous leaders said these were positive steps, but didn't address the overarching issues. Protest leaders say they will not back down, and if past national actions in Ecuador are any sign of what's to come, the tension on the streets in the coming days will only increase. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
This week, international governing bodies for rugby and swimming announced new policies for elite transgender athletes. Neither policy is going to please transgender athletes. The World's Bianca Hillier covers LGBTQ news for us. Hey, Bianca.
Hi, Carol.
Bianca, let's start with rugby. What's been the decision?
Yeah, the International Rugby League said today that trans women are not allowed to compete in their competitions at all. And this includes the World Cup later this year. But they said this isn't their final policy. They just need more time to research the topic. So this announcement is a stopgap to, quote, balance the individual's right to participate against perceived risk to other participants, end quote. And the IRL says they'll announce their formal inclusion policy next year.
Okay, what about swimming? FINA, I know, is the sports international governing body. Is their decision similar to rugby's?
It is similar, but different in a few key ways. So FINA has decided to effectively ban trans women from competing in women's races, including at major events like the Olympics. This includes not just swimming, but also diving, water polo, artistic swimming, high diving, and open water swimming. And FINA says trans women will only be allowed to compete if they transitioned before going through puberty or before age 12, whichever is later. But trans men are allowed to compete in men's competitions. This new policy is effective now, and it was passed with 71% of the vote from FINA members, which they say did include trans athletes and coaches.
Bianca, what reason are the sports governing bodies giving for putting these rules against transgender women in place?
They say they're working to ensure fairness in sport. For example, in FINA's new policy, they say the ban on trans women is necessary because of the performance gap that emerges at puberty between people assigned male and female at birth. FINA says if eligibility standards were not based on sex-linked traits, then cisgender female athletes would lose more races and be at greater risk of injury.
So what are trans women supposed to do? I mean, are they allowed to compete in any capacity?
In the new policy, FINA proposed what they're calling an open competition category for people who they say don't qualify for the women's category. But there aren't a lot of details about this yet, hardly any in fact, and they say a new working group will spend the next 6 months looking at the most effective ways to set it up, and it's unclear at this point whether they will have any trans women or trans athletes in that working group.
Bianca, give us some context. Why are these decisions coming out now?
This is all in response to guidelines that the International Olympic Committee put out last November. They said athletes should not be assumed to have an unfair advantage just because they're trans or intersex. And they advocated for inclusion and an evidence-based approach. But, Carol, these were just suggested guidelines. The IOC said it was up to each sport to make their own rules. So governing bodies put together working groups, and now we're starting to see those results.
This is a topic that a lot of people are really passionate about. What's the reaction been like?
Yeah, a handful of top cisgender female swimmers have publicly applauded FINA's new policy and thanked them for maintaining a, quote, fair sport. But human rights activists and trans athletes are condemning the policy. On Instagram, trans swimmer Skylar Baylar spoke out against FINA's requirement for athletes to transition before puberty.
They want you to have transitioned before 12 in order to compete in the women's category. But in the United States, we have nearly 100 bills that have been trying to ban trans kids from receiving gender-affirming healthcare. So you can't transition before 12. You can't even transition before 18.
And Carol, activists are also worried that these exclusionary policies will have a knock-on effect outside of sports, too. On Twitter, trans athlete Chris Mosier said that banning trans people from certain spaces in sports sets up a dynamic in the real world where trans folks are the targets of even more harm.
The World's Bianca Hillier covers LGBTQ news for us. She's been reporting on the recent bans on trans athletes in sports. Bianca, thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Carol.
Coming up, poll the countries that make up the African Union, and you'll get a wide range of views on the war in Ukraine. Russia's influence in Africa, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Since the start of Russia's invasion, Lithuania has been one of Ukraine's strongest supporters. The Baltic nation has supplied Ukraine with lots of weapons. Then last week, Lithuania said it will no longer allow Russia to transfer sanctioned goods across Lithuanian territory to Kaliningrad. That's a small patch of Russian territory on the Baltic Sea, surrounded by European Union members. Moscow has reacted to the blockade with fury. Joining me now is Denis Chanusha. He's a political risk analyst at the Eastern Europe Studies Center. Denis, first tell us a little bit more about Kaliningrad. Where is it located geographically and why is it part of Russia?
Kaliningrad is basically surrounded by the EU member states and it's an exclave. So it's a territory which is belonging to Russia. But in order to reach that place, Russia should use either the maritime ways or through the railway and the airspace. So the region is small and it is very much dependent on how it coexists with the countries that are right now in very bad relations with Russia. So it's both politically and economically dependent on those that surround its territories. And obviously the relations with Russia matters for the economic survival of Kaliningrad.
So Lithuania decided to cut off sanctioned goods that used to be shipped by rail via Lithuania into Kaliningrad. How significant is this move?
First of all, it's a very important decision of the Lithuanian authorities because this is something that they are expected to do as they are part of the EU and they should implement the sanctions. That's kind of a responsibility of all member states, and they are monitored by Brussels in terms of how they implement, how they enforce the sanctions. So this is not a unilateral decision, but rather something that is expected from all 27 members of the EU, and therefore Lithuania is not an outlier in this regards. But the specificity of Lithuania is that it has been always part of some arrangements between the EU and Russia before it became part of the EU. So it should be always very careful about how Russia perceives its policy, the policy of Vilnius, towards Kaliningrad.
What role does Kaliningrad play in terms of Russia's security or its overall military posture in the region?
It's more way of pretending of having geopolitical and geostrategic interests. Of course, Russia is always talking about protecting its areas, but also its citizens that are somehow now projected as being in a blockade that has been created by Lithuania, which is, of course, not true. But as we all are aware of, there is a huge and powerful propaganda. And therefore, for the Russians to adopt certain decisions in Moscow against Lithuania, it's very important to show or to try to convince the public opinion that Lithuania is an enemy. So therefore, this negative discourse against Vilnius probably is going to be followed by some measures. We don't know exactly what will be the measures, but we can assume that probably Russia is going to try maybe to use the maritime ways of sending ships, military ships, to the Baltic Sea and try to basically scare Vilnius in order to obtain certain concessions when it comes to the resuming of the transit of certain goods to Kaliningrad via Lithuania.
Denis Chanusha is a political risk analyst at the Eastern Europe Studies Center. He's been speaking with us about Lithuania cutting off rail access of sanctioned Russian goods to Kaliningrad. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The war in Ukraine has taken a toll on global food supplies, and that's had an especially hard impact on Africa. Yesterday, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky told representatives of the African Union that Russia has taken the African continent hostage. Russia's allies in Africa, though, might disagree. Ebenezer Obodare is a senior fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He joins us from Washington. Ebenezer, what did Volodymyr Zelensky hope to accomplish with his address to the African Union yesterday?
Thank you, Carol, for having me. I think President Zelensky is hoping to achieve what he's been planning to achieve from the get-go, which is to win African countries away from Russia and get them to support the West and ipso facto Ukraine in the ongoing conflict.
Now, it's interesting. It's been reported by the Associated Press that it has taken weeks of requests by Ukraine for President Zelensky to address the African Union. And even at that, it was a closed-door meeting. Why?
Right from the beginning, President Zelensky had been seeking the attention of African leaders, especially after those early polls at the United Nations, where it seemed that African countries were either going to explicitly oppose Ukraine or were going to back Russia, or some of them were just going to sit on the fence. So President Zelensky anticipated that, and he's been trying to have a meeting with the African Union. He's been doing that for at least 3 months now, and I think it's a good thing that at the last, African countries have decided to listen to him.
What's the ambivalence by some African nations to having a kind of full-throated support for Ukraine in this war?
There's a lot of history here. Many African countries feel that African countries have been inferiorized in the international system, that African agency historically has been diminished. And they felt that the West felt that African countries should just come along without any questions being asked. For many African countries, the Ukraine-Russia conflict has been an opportunity to ventilate grievances that have been bubbling under the surface for a very long time.
So put another way, what do those countries get out of their relationship with Russia?
Russia is the largest arms supplier to African countries. Russia has historically, this is speaking about the Soviet Union, provided ideological support for many African countries, South Africa being the most important one in the struggle against apartheid. Russia has been the reliable friend where in the past the West has wavered. So for many of those countries, this is the time not to abandon an ally that has stood firm by them for so long.
Well, it's interesting. At the beginning of June, the head of the African Union, Senegal's president, Macky Sall, he was quick to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Russia. He also echoed Russia's accusations that Western sanctions are causing the rising food costs. Why is the head of the African Union siding with Russia so publicly?
Again, this goes back to what I said earlier on about the fact that many of them perceive that Western countries have not always lived up to their moral rhetoric. I think President Macky Sall is coming from that background. To be clear, the reason we are talking about him is that he's the leader of the African Union. But he appears to be representing a cross-section of opinion of many African leaders.
I guess my final question is, when Zelensky addressed the African Union yesterday, it was to like four countries. I mean, barely any countries showed up. What are the African countries looking for from Ukraine and Zelensky?
I don't think this is really about Ukraine. It's more about Russia, Ukraine, and the West at the same time. I think President Zelensky should continue to knock on the door of African countries. But more important, President Zelensky should remind African countries and African leaders of what is morally at stake in this conflict. The invasion of one country by another country. This is something that African countries, given their own history, have to care about. And it would be a tragedy if they were to let this opportunity pass. So if I were drafting that, you know, 5 minute, 2 minute speech on behalf of President Zelensky, that's what I'm going to pivot my speech around.
We've been speaking to Ebenezer Obodare. He's a senior fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carol.
You're listening to The World. A video game developer in China built one of the most profitable games ever, even with Beijing's strict censorship laws.
It's not just found success in China, but it's found success globally. The scale it's been able to achieve is unlike any other game.
The game has become a subtle way to promote the Chinese way of life internationally. Plus, the U.S. and Iranian navies play a high-stakes game of chicken at sea. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. If you follow the news or are a listener to this program, you've no doubt heard of Xinjiang. That's the vast region in northwestern China where Beijing has detained more than 1 million people, mostly Muslim Uyghurs. Xinjiang has become a manufacturing powerhouse. Huge industrial parks are located right next to so-called re-education camps. Forced Uyghur laborers harvest fields of cotton and tomatoes. But starting to today, U.S. officials will begin to implement a law that prohibits the importation of products made by forced labor in Xinjiang. To find out how this will work, we reached out to Allison Gill. She's a program director with the Global Labor Justice International Labor Rights Forum. Allison, what sort of products made by forced labor in Xinjiang have been coming into the U.S.?
Just a vast array of products, primarily cotton products, textiles, garments, fast fashion, but also polysilicon used in solar panels, car parts, toys, PVC piping and vinyl flooring, pharmaceutical products. I think what we don't understand, or what many don't understand, is that there is just an enormous range of goods that are affected by forced labor in the Uyghur region.
Sure sounds like it. So if I look around my house, will I likely find products made by forced labor in Xinjiang?
Yes, there's a high risk that most of us have goods that are made with Uyghur forced labor in our purses, on our desks, in our closets. The Uyghur region produces just huge amounts of consumer goods, electronics used in our cell phones and agricultural products in our pantries like tomato paste. So there is a high risk of Uyghur forced labor tainting a lot of everyday products.
The Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, that goes into effect today. What does that mean for U.S. companies? What are they now required to do?
What it means for all companies, not just U.S. companies, but all companies that want to bring in goods to sell in the United States, is that there is a presumption now that any good that is manufactured, harvested, mined, or produced in whole or in part in the Uyghur region is produced with forced labor and therefore barred from coming into the U.S.
So do companies now have to find new sources for their materials? I mean, how do they determine whether there's forced labor and therefore what do they have to change about how they're making their goods?
The primary thing that companies have to change is that they now have to know their supply chains. They actually have to know down to the raw material level where all of the inputs in their goods are coming from. Companies typically haven't known this and haven't had to know it.
And how easy is it for them to know their sourcing, to know the whole supply chain? I mean, is there transparency around that?
Well, companies will tell you that it's hard, but I can tell you that NGOs and researchers and academics and journalists have been finding out this information and documenting forced labor in well-known supply chains. And so companies need to do it too.
Even if this ban is robustly enforced in the U.S., what's to prevent China from selling tainted products elsewhere?
Nothing. So this is a real risk. So we are calling on companies to apply a single standard across their supply chains. Otherwise, Europe, Australia, Japan, and other major markets risk becoming a dumping ground for forced labor goods. So companies that are now barred from selling goods to the U.S. shouldn't be allowed to turn around and re-export those goods and sell them to Europe.
What's been the reaction to this by stores and companies and manufacturers? I mean, do they seem to have good intentions and know how to follow the rules, or are they reacting like this is one big, huge annoyance?
Companies have been saying for years that they have zero tolerance policies for forced labor. This law actually enforces those policies and makes companies prove that these commitments are real. The law was signed in December. Companies have now had 6 months to understand whether or not they are already in violation potentially of the law. And so, you know, today, if they're complaining or claiming that this is impossible or a big headache, you know, I think we have to really understand that they've known for months, if not years, that forced labor in Xinjiang is a problem and that they are benefiting ultimately from forced labor. And it's their responsibility to eradicate it from their supply chains.
Allison Gill is a program director with the Global Labor Justice International Labor Rights Forum. Thanks for being with us, Allison.
Thanks very much.
Next, we have a story about geopolitics, but it's set in anime fantasy land. The new Chinese-made video game Genshin Impact has exploded in popularity. The Chinese government has long been suspicious of video games. It limits how long kids can play them and censors their content. But Genshin Impact may present another path forward. That's because this video game presents an idealized version of the Chinese way of life. Dina Temple-Raston with the podcast Click Here has our story.
Imagine a velvety green meadow dappled with sunlight. On the horizon, you can just make out a cluster of pagodas perched on a beautiful cliff.
Windborn Outlander, as you set off on your journey once again, you must remember that the journey itself has meaning.
And you, a tall anime traveler with a flowing cape and a long sword, or walking through an open-world role-playing game called Genshin Impact. It makes you feel like you're inside a highly produced anime movie set in an idealized and timeless Chinese world. The landscapes are lush and sparkling, and you are one of its attractive, scantily clad characters, exploring it all.
Yet buried in the depths of this world lies smoldering remains, a warning to those that dare trespass. That throne in the sky is not reserved for you.
Playing it is very metaverse, and some reviewers have called Genshin Impact gaming perfection.
None will escape the flames. See for yourself.
Not only because it's visually stunning, but technically flawless too. There's no glitchy music or characters who freeze while the game is buffering on your phone. And one of the big surprises is where it came from: China. Typically, these wildly popular games come out of the US or Japan. Genshin is China's first blockbuster entry. Genshin Impact is set in an anime world called Teyvat. It's all waterfalls, rushing rivers, and big lush plants that, if you whack them in just the right way, reveal hidden treasure. It's the kind of game that everyone can play, from aficionados to, well, this little person.
I am in a city that has lots of beautiful flowers in it.
That's Naomi King. She's 5, and she loves Genshin Impact. Partly because there are lots of characters in the game that look like princesses, which she loves.
It's beautiful and a lovely town, and it's very sunny there.
Right now it's nighttime.
Her dad, Austin King, is also an avid player, and he's been teaching her the finer points of the game.
So you don't want to stand in the fire. And right now, Ningguang, the character she's using, has a shield that she can throw up around herself, and so she's throwing up the shield so that the goblins' arrows don't hit her.
I'm trying to be stealth and be sneaky, really sneaky.
She's been learning about stealth in video games. That's her latest kick.
Yeah, still and sneaky.
Stealth, yeah, doing sneaky.
In addition to being Naomi's dad, Austin is also the features editor at Screen Rant and host of a podcast called Dragon Quest FM. This sort of role-playing fantasy game is one of his favorite things, and he's been playing Genshin.
Since the day it came out.
Really?
Not every day, but I've played it ever since it came out.
Genshin's developer, HoYoVerse, used to be called miHoYo, keeps people coming back by updating the game every 6 weeks, like clockwork. And every time, there are new kingdoms to explore, new storylines, new characters, and they make every update an event. A lot of games get updated, but not with this kind of regularity or fanfare. It's like a movie premiere.
So there's an addicting quality to it. And this is how Genshin Impact makes their money.
HoYoVerse entices players with a way to level up faster that seems an awful lot like good old-fashioned gambling. You give HoYoVerse real money, and in return, you get to pull a little lever and...
I got a sword.
Another sword.
Sword.
Oh my goodness.
Sword. But I can try a few more times.
If you don't get what you want, you just give HoYoVerse more money and spin again. Like a slot machine, that element of chance can be addicting.
We've got a few more to do a few more wishes here. Oh!
Got a new character! She has purple hair, and purple is my favorite color.
Genshin Impact breaks in about $1 billion every 6 months. And last month, it reportedly passed the $3 billion mark in mobile revenue. That makes it more successful than old powerhouse favorites like Fortnite and Pokemon Go. And the truth is, this kind of massive response doesn't usually happen to Chinese games. They tend to have mostly domestic audiences in the dog-eat-dragon world of gaming.
Let's play! Time for takeoff!
So at first blush, this all seems like a great success story from an unlikely source. But there's a subtext. This is about more than developing China's gaming industry. It's about what makes a game uniquely Chinese in the first place. Beijing officials see Genshin not just as another popular video game, they see it as a vehicle to export something bigger, a virtuous Chinese way of life. So in this idealized Chinese world, you can kill the dragon or your opponent, but you can't watch them bleed. There may be suggestions of romance, characters who go on adventures who clearly like each other more than just friends. But those relationships are strictly heterosexual. Same-sex couples are not an option. As a general matter, games, especially immersive world-building games, where you get to set the rules, are a perfect vehicle for China's geopolitical aspirations. Genshin Impact allows them to dress up Chinese communist values, like working for the collective good, in princess clothes. And who could possibly resist that? Not surprisingly, China keeps a tight rein on their video games. There's not just a ban on swearing or violence. Free expression isn't allowed either. Consider the case of the Hong Kong pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong. He was playing a game called Animal Crossing, and it allows you to decorate your own environment. So he added a banner to his little metaverse that read, "Free Hong Kong, Revolution Now," and then he shared a screenshot of it on Twitter. A short time later, the entire game disappeared from Taobao, China's version of eBay. Because of that one little banner, China banned the game outright. In fact, Chinese players can't even buy it in the gray market anymore. Jeff Knockel is a researcher at the Monk School at the University of Toronto, where he focuses on internet freedom.
Specifically, in my case, censorship and Chinese censorship in particular.
And he said it's so hard to know what will run afoul of the regulators, Knockel decided to do a study of it. He and his colleagues analyzed more than 200 games and found 180,000 blacklisted words and phrases. They looked at video games specifically simply because there were so many of them to study.
And it allows you to ask questions that we weren't really able to answer looking at other industry segments. You know, like if you look at like chat apps, for instance, there's generally only a few popular chat apps at any given time. You know, then we wanted to do some more like comparative analysis. Like we really wanted to get down to this question of like, do all apps in China censor the same things? Do they not? And, you know, due to the huge diversity of the number of games that are popular at any time, this allowed us an opportunity to really explore that question.
And what he found was that game developers in China have started creating their own running list of China's unacceptable words, and they actually share it with their competitors. And, according to Knockel, the most common censored items were what he calls the Chinese F-words.
There's like a Falun Gong, which is the controversial spiritual movement there.
Right.
And then there's sort of like the more sort of like, it doesn't start with an F in Chinese, but, you know, like what we would call the F-word in English, like that was also censored a lot as well.
In a game like Genshin Impact, China can restrict free speech by policing the chat function. Type the word Tibet in the chat, and the word appears just as a series of asterisks, automatically. As much as China wants to control the language and the content of the game, they're also very focused on how much kids can play it. Last August,
from today, children in China will only be allowed to play online video games for three
hours a week, and only on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Tian Wang.
Any parent who has a kid who games too much should probably take note. China limits gaming to three times a week, just Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights, for 1 hour. And thanks to a system that allows the party to keep close tabs on what its youth is doing online, the restrictions are actually enforceable. So you know China has limited gaming for kids. Austin, do you think it's ironic that it's put out this incredibly addictive game while internally they're not letting their own people play it?
Yes, I think so. I think it's pretty ironic. Especially, Genshin Impact, it was like one of the biggest games in the world last year. And it is kind of odd that they're limiting something that has now, like, gotten a lot of praise probably for their country.
And now I'm gonna go over here because I think I see something I can fight.
Austin King has come up with a less draconian solution to limit Naomi's gaming.
She had just gotten in trouble for not being a very good listener. That's kind of like a default thing to sometimes take away. So she lost the video game privileges for a week.
I would play it like every day if I didn't have it. Okay. Oh, there's a slime and two goblins and a bug. I don't know what it is.
At that moment, Naomi was flying up a mountain, surrounded by goblins, completely immersed in a world unlike her own. And I gotta say, it looked pretty fun. For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Rasta.
This story comes to us from Click Here, a podcast about the world of cyber and intelligence. It was produced by Will Jarvis and Sean Powers. International diplomacy can sometimes feel like a high-stakes game of chicken, each side waiting for the other to blink. At sea yesterday, it was more of a literal game of chicken. A small Iranian speedboat came charging at an American warship, only to swerve away at the last moment. It happened in the Strait of Hormuz, a key oil shipping corridor. The U.S. Navy released a video of the incident, and it's also now saying a similar confrontation took place in March. Here to explain what's going on is Mehran Hagirian. He's a director at the think tank Bors Bazar, which focuses on diplomatic, economic, and national security issues with Iran. Mehran, do we have any idea why these near misses are happening?
So these kinds of incidents happen from time to time, but they get more frequent when there's an impasse in diplomacy between Tehran and Washington. But as you just mentioned, in March, a similar incident took place, and it was quite more dangerous as well. But the U.S. decided not to publicize it for the sake of not damaging the nuclear negotiations that were going on in Vienna at the time. But because they just announced it now, it's quite probable that there were many more of such incidents as well.
Why do you think these kind of things happen? An Iranian speedboat kind of going after U.S. ships, kind of taunting them. What's the point here?
I definitely think that they are taunting them because they don't really achieve anything from these things, aside from the fact that there are these reports coming out that Iran has been harassing American ships. But one thing is important to mention is that until at least 2019, there was a point of contact between Iran and the U.S. That basically evaporated after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian commander. Since then, there's no other way aside from firing flare shots or using the horns of the ships to deflect Iranian actions in the Persian Gulf.
The point of contact you're referring to, of course, is between the U.S. military and the IRGC. That was sort of severed after the assassination of General Soleimani.
Yes, that basically stopped. So there's no more point of contact between Iran and Washington. Up until then, if any incidents were about to take place, at least there was a way that Iranian ships or bases could reach American ships. But that no longer is the case.
You mentioned, of course, the kind of stalled renegotiation of the nuclear agreement. And you think that is the kind of the backstory to these?
Currently, the main discussions that are ongoing between Iran and the U.S. are related to the nuclear issue. And we can see in the past year, there have been some incidents like this when the negotiations in Vienna were not going anywhere or when Iran was saying the U.S. was demanding too much. So I think it's directly tied to what's going on in Vienna or not, actually, because they're not in Vienna at the moment.
The U.S. Navy captured the latest incident on video. It's pretty clear the Iranian speedboat is heading straight at the American warship. Iran hasn't acknowledged the incident, though. What's the thinking there?
It is interesting because I was just actually checking Iranian media. The only thing that you could see in the semi-official news sites are the reports of the Washington Post reporting of the incident. I would think Iran does not want to necessarily acknowledge that such an incident took place, but at the same time, it could be because these incidents are recurring quite often in the region.
The Strait of Hormuz is a major shipping lane for oil. Do incidents like this threaten the stability of this route in any significant way?
Definitely. We saw in the summer of 2019 when there were many incidents taking place in the Persian Gulf off the coast of the UAE, for example, in Fujairah, or the attacks in Saudi Arabia, in which briefly halted oil production. So these kinds of incidents have a direct impact on energy resources as well. Because of those incidents in 2019 and 2020, we also saw that the Europeans got involved in the region, and they created this European Maritime Security Initiative in the Strait of Hormuz. They actually wanted to be more engaged in maritime security issues of the region because of the threats that they were facing in the energy markets.
Is there a danger that these things could escalate into something more serious?
Definitely. There's always the danger that these incidents could lead to further escalation or actual military conflicts in the region.
Mehran Hegirian is Director of Regional Initiatives at the think tank Bors Bazar, which focuses on diplomatic, economic, and national security issues with Iran. Thanks, Mehran.
Thank you very much.
Today was the last day of the all-important end-of-year school exams in Syria. Students there have reason to celebrate, but so does the rest of the country. That's because it means no more internet blackouts. Why, you ask? Well, Syria, like many countries in the Middle East, where exam cheating is rampant, has been turning off the internet just as students sit down for their tests. It's an effort to prevent exams from being leaked and students sharing answers on social media.
In the last month, there have been 4 blackouts in Syria. A research organization called IOTA at Georgia Tech has been tracking them and found that internet went out for the entire country 4 times for multiple hours in the early mornings.
That's Rebecca Jackson, who writes for The Economist. She says people are furious because internet blackouts affect everyone, not just students.
Human rights activists are very angry. It's an infringement on people's freedom, and it's just really tricky to get by day to day without internet. On top of that, the Syrian government promised last year they were going to stop this practice entirely. And sure enough, as soon as exam season rolled around, the blackouts resumed.
But does it work? Jackson says that extreme measures like shutting down the internet for an entire country does not seem to be forcing students to be more honest.
Cheating became so rampant that in Algeria, the government ordered 500,000 students, that's 40% of the students who took the test, to retake their exams in 2016. And the same year, an anonymous Facebook page in Syria posted exam questions minutes before the exam began. Their justification for doing so was that they were promoting equity by giving poor students the same advantages that rich ones had already paid for. So the idea here is that kids are just cheating all over the place. But it doesn't seem that the outages actually reduce cheating. People seem to find a way around them. In Iraq, in 2018, when there were full targeted outages for this purpose, education officials were still accused of selling exam questions.
And the economic costs from these outages is widespread and massive.
So you can imagine that a cab driver can't process any electronic payments, or hospitals can't search for patient records in their system. And it turns out that NetBlocks, a digital research firm, estimates that since 2019, the blackouts have cost Syria $88 million. And across 7 Middle Eastern and North African countries, the losses have amounted to $370 million. This is also probably a lowball, because these cost estimates don't include the fact that investors have probably lost confidence in these countries' economies because of the blackouts.
With all these costs, you'd think that countries would find other ways to curtail cheating.
It sort of seems that countries are resorting to this practice a little bit less over time, but it doesn't actually seem that they're going to stop it entirely. For example, last year, the Minister of Education in Syria promised that they would stop this practice of inflicting blackouts during exam seasons. But then, as this year's exams rolled around, they seemed to continue. So any plans to change in Syria appear to be nothing more than empty promises.
Rebecca Jackson writes for The Economist. She spoke to our partners at the Intelligence Podcast about countries that turn off the internet to prevent students from cheating on their exams. And that's where we pull the plug on today's program. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We'll be back with you tomorrow.